This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Sudan's residents say they're cautiously optimistic about the Saudi and U.S. brokered peace talks in Jeddah between Sudan's warring generals amid reports of a lull in fighting. Michael Teet reports from Sudan.
Representatives of the military and the rapid support forces are invited to Jeddah to discuss a proposed ceasefire so humanitarian aid agencies can access people who are wounded, hungry, or displaced after more than 3 weeks of fighting. The Sudan Tribune reported Sunday that the army negotiators have met demands, including unconditional withdrawal of the rapid support forces from the capital, Khartoum, an extension of the humanitarian truce, and the integration of the RSF into the Sudanese army within 2 years. The newspaper said it is not clear how the RSF negotiators will respond to these demands. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
Ukraine air defense has shot down 35 Iranian-made drones over Kyiv overnight Monday in Russia's latest nighttime assault. We get more from AP correspondent Charles Iledesma.
If Mayor Vitaly Klitschko has been visiting damaged apartments in the city and tells the AP defenses had worked well during the onslaught.
Kamikaze drones fly to direction in our hometown. And thanks to the anti-missile system, everyone was shot down.
Drone wreckage struck a two-story apartment block in a western Kyiv district, while five people in the capital were injured by falling debris, according to the Kyiv City Military Administration. In addition, Russian forces also used long-range bombers to launch up to 8 cruise missiles at Ukraine's southern Odessa region overnight. Some of the Soviet-era missiles self-destructed or fell into the sea before striking targets. I'm Charles Duladesma.
And this is VOA News. The White House and Congress could strike a deal to raise the nation's debt ceiling in exchange for budget cuts, or they could agree to a stopgap measure to keep paying America's bills while negotiations continue. They could also do nothing, sending the economy into chaos. As U.S. President Joe Biden prepares to meet with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and leaders of Congress on Tuesday, the options for easing the debt ceiling standoff are many, but the political incentive for compromise is harder to come by. There's no easy endgame ahead of a June 1st deadline to raise the debt ceiling or risk default. U.S. President Joe Biden says that his administration will write new rules to expand the rights of airline passengers. Biden said Monday that the rules will require airlines to compensate passengers and cover their meals in hotel rooms if they're stranded for reasons within the airline's control. It's the Democratic administration's latest salvo at the airlines, and it comes just weeks before the busy summer travel season. Airlines for America, which represents the biggest carrier, says the airlines have no incentive to delay or cancel flights. The trade group blames weather and air traffic control outages for most delays. Banks are reporting tougher credit standards in the wake of recent bank failures. We get more details from AP correspondent Ed Donahue.
Report by the Federal Reserve shows about half of banks surveyed raised standards for business and consumer loans after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic Bank. A majority of banks plan to tighten credit as the year goes on. It could slow the economy and increase the risk of a recession. The standards include demanding higher credit scores, charging higher interest rates, or requiring more collateral. A reduction in lending could force businesses to pull back on expansion plans and reduce hiring, and could limit sales of cars and homes. The survey was done before the collapse of First Republic Bank. Ed Donahue, Washington.
More details are emerging about the victims of the weekend mass shooting in Texas. AP correspondent Norman Hall.
People killed by a gunman at a mall near Dallas include two elementary school-age sisters, a couple and their three-year-old son, and a young engineer from India. The victims represent a multicultural cross-section of the metropolitan area's increasingly diverse suburbs. Also killed at the outdoor shopping center were three members of a Korean-American family, a couple and one of their sons, who was three. Another son was wounded. An assistant manager at the mall's Tommy Hilfiger said she was devastated to learn the day after running for her life that one of the dead was a 20-year-old security guard who previously worked at the clothing store and often stopped in to chat.
That's AP's Norman Hall. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
The U.S. grapples with gun violence in the aftermath of another mass shooting.
This is a crisis. Congress must do something about it.
Plus, Ukraine remains defiant in the aftermath of the biggest Russian drone bombardment in months.
According to Mayor Vitaly Klitschko, Russia fired 60 Iranian-made kamikaze drones at targets in Ukraine.
And we hear from the Ukrainian musical duo vying for the coveted Eurovision title. Today is Tuesday, May 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. Texas officials have identified the eight people killed in a suburban Dallas, Texas shopping mall, including a three-year-old boy and two grade school girls. As investigators piece together what led to the latest mass shooting, President Biden is appealing to Congress to take action against gun violence. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters on Monday the president has taken all the executive action that he can.
Where's Congress's responsibility on this? Where's their responsibility on this? We need legislation. It is frustrating, and I'm sure you all are frustrated too, to talk about this over and over again. Averaging out to one mass shooting a week? That's not okay.
Authorities say the 33-year-old gunman's posts on a social media site indicate he'd been planning the attack for weeks, had a fascination with white supremacy, and shared photos of large Nazi tattoos on his arm and torso. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signed a bill on Monday to officially mark May 8th as the Day of Remembrance and Victory over Nazism in World War II, breaking from Russia's May 9th V-Day anniversary tradition. As Emma Gell reports from Reuters, the defiant act follows the biggest swarm of Russian drone attacks in Ukraine in months on Monday, the eve of Russia's celebration of the defeat of Nazi Germany.
Russia's military hit Ukrainian cities with its largest drone swarm attack in months on Monday, just a day before Victory Day, a celebration of the Soviet triumph over Nazi Germany in 1945, and the most important day in the Russian calendar under President Vladimir Putin. The drone swarm is the latest in a renewed Russian air campaign launched 10 days ago. This is damage from the strikes done to apartment blocks in Kyiv. A resident, Volodymyr, said his wife and child would have slept right there. According to Mayor Vitaly Klitschko, Russia fired 60 Iranian-made kamikaze drones at targets in Ukraine. 36 targeted the capital, all of which were shot down, he said.
Right now we're in the apartment, one of the buildings. Today was one of the massive attacks to our hometown. Five people was taken injuries, two people right now in hospitals. But nobody has died. It's very important.
In Bakhmut, the Ukrainian government says Russian forces appear to be making a final push, hoping to capture it ahead of the May 9th holiday and deliver the only prize for Putin in a costly winter offensive. The battle for the besieged city has been one of the bloodiest of the 14-month war. The medics aboard this makeshift ambulance say they retrieved six wounded soldiers Monday, most of them from Bakhmut. As the wounded are taken from the front lines, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky further cemented Ukraine's break with its Soviet past. Speaking to the nation on a hill overlooking Kyiv, Zelensky said the old evil had returned, this time waged by a modern Russia. Zelensky said he had submitted a bill to parliament officially making May 8th a day of remembrance and victory, while May 9th, Russia's Victory Day, would become Europe Day.
Reuters reporter Emma Jahel. A wave of mass arrests in Turkey's predominantly Kurdish region ahead of the May 14th national elections is triggering concerns among the opposition and human rights observers. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Diyarbakir, Turkey's largest majority Kurdish city.
Parliamentary candidate Sorgul Aytek Afşar is campaigning hard for the pro-Kurdish Green Left Party It's been under siege, accused of links to separatists who've been fighting in the region for decades. Ahead of polls, many of its elected mayors and parliamentary deputies are already in jail. Sorgul Aytek Avşar of the Green Left Party. She said, "We are all under the same pressure. Anything can happen at any moment, whether you're an MP or a candidate, whether you're a staff member here, whether you make tea here or bring newspapers here. We're all struggling against the same mentality because we're all under the same pressure." Last month, the legal crackdown extended to the region's independent media. The Mesopotamia news agency is short-staffed after its editor and several journalists were detained under anti-terror legislation. Arjun Dilek Öncel is editor-in-chief of the Mesopotamia Ajans. She said they are accused of membership in an illegal organization, but they cannot find any concrete evidence to establish any connection to membership in an illegal organization. It's only because of their news reports. In fact, the government is aware that something would change with the Kurdish vote in this election, especially in the last period after the pandemic. Turkey's had a serious economic crisis. Rights groups have condemned the journalists' arrests, which are part of a wider crackdown involving over 200 detentions of people, including lawyers and civil society members. This is raising concerns about election security, says Abdullah Zeytun, head of the Diyarbakır branch of the Independent Human Rights Association.
Genel tabirle zamanlaması manidar oldu çünkü...
He said the arrest timing is meaningful because all these people are actively involved in observing the election process. People who will identify and prevent voting violations that might occur during this process or will report on these violations. The government says the judiciary is independent. Accounting for about a fifth of the population, the Kurdish vote is key to the outcome of May's presidential and parliamentary elections. This is especially so as the pro-Kurdish Green Left Party is now supporting Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu against incumbent President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, with Kılıçdaroğlu vowing to free imprisoned Kurdish politicians and constitutional reform. The elections offers an opportunity for fundamental change. That's what candidate Avşar for the Green Left Party says. She says this is actually an historic election, and it coincides with the country's republic entering its second century. We want it to be a democratic beginning, replacing an old rigid system without respect to human rights, with a constitution that is inclusive, democratic, and for freedoms. Given the high stakes, campaigning is intensifying with only days left before an election that many see as key to the country's future. Doreen Jones for VOA News, Diyarbakır.
Here are some of the other stories we are following from around the world. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan discussed efforts to end the war in Yemen as he met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman Sunday. A White House statement said the two also discussed Saudi Arabia's support for U.S. citizens who evacuated from Sudan following the recent outbreak of fighting. Thousands have marched in silence in Serbia in a major outpouring triggered by two mass shootings last week that left 17 people dead and 21 wounded. The shootings on Wednesday at a school in Belgrade and a day later in a rural area south of the capital left the nation in shock. And a new study finds daily tides of increasingly warmer water have eaten a massive hole at the bottom of one of Greenland's major glaciers in the last couple years. And scientists worry the action isn't limited to this one glacier, raising questions about previous projections of melting rates on the world's vulnerable ice sheets. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers using data from ESA's Gaia mission has discovered the closest black hole to Earth. They also found that it and another are in a new class of black holes. Both were found to be dormant black holes and are in binary systems, with each having a companion star. Since they were inactive, the black holes were found by studying the movement of their accompanying stars. The newly found object, called Gaia BH1, is located only 1,600 light-years away, and the second black hole, called Gaia BH2, is about 3,800 light-years away. They are considered to be stellar mass black holes since they each weigh the equivalent of 10 suns. These black holes were put into a new class because the distance between them and their companion stars is much greater than other binary systems with black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. As prices for food and goods remain high in many countries, some economists say the persistent inflation is partly due to corporate profit-seeking. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias has the details.
At the International Monetary Fund in Washington, researcher Daniel Lee says there is cautious optimism about global inflation levels easing this year.
But this is going to be a long fight. We don't think most countries will get to their inflation target until 2025.
Different factors have contributed to advanced and developing economies exceeding their inflation targets.
One was the boost to energy prices and food prices, partly from the war in Ukraine. And on top of that, a lot of countries are dealing with labor market shortages, not enough workers, that's driving up wages.
In capitalist economies, when demand goes up, prices also rise. But some analysts see an unusual form of inflation, even as in their assessment, demand holds fairly stable. Paul Donovan, chief economist for UBS Global Wealth Management via Skype.
Generally, companies that are quite close to consumers, so at the end of the supply chain, if you like, these companies have been able to persuade their customers to accept not just the cost increases, but the cost increases and then a little bit more. And that little bit more is, of course, an increase in profit margin.
It might not be a sustainable approach, Donovan noted.
If consumers start saying, actually, that's not a fair price increase, I'm not going to pay that, then what you see is companies starting to worry that if they raise their profit margins too far, their brand value is going to be damaged.
The National Retail Federation represents a full spectrum of companies. Their lead researcher affirms that consumer demand has increased dramatically and describes the profit-led inflation arguments as, quote, very simplistic. Mark Matthews is the Federation's Vice President of Research Development.
Every single day, many of our members think about lowering prices. The problem, though, in some cases, is that, you know, when the goods, the prices of goods are rising all over the place and the inventories are low, then, you know, retailers have to be able to, you know, pass some of those costs along to consumers.
What some may see as price gouging, others may view as businesses charging what the market will bear. Some may decry excess profits, while others note that maximizing profit is the norm in a free market system. Economists say profit can also rise through good management practices. Jonathan Fortune is an economist with the Institute of International Finance.
If you have better clients, or if you have a better human capital inside your company, definitely you're going to have the potential of actually having larger profit margins.
Cooling consumer demand can force companies to abandon price hikes and rein in inflation, a key goal of the U.S. Central Bank, which recently boosted interest rates for the 10th time in just over a year. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
South Africans are embracing the continent's first professional cuddling service, where customers pay for platonic intimacy. Experts say isolation during the COVID pandemic, which hit South Africa hard, and stress from its struggling economy are just two reasons why the cuddling business is booming. Zahir Kasim reports from Johannesburg.
For some, it's hard to wrap one's arms around the idea of a professional cuddling service. But the business is gaining popularity in South Africa. One company, Pro Cuddling, is leading the way. It was founded by Florence Letswalo.
I feel like these days the culture is very much about people doing their own thing, not caring about what somebody's going through and all that. And for me, I was like, how do we find a way to bring people together? Because yes, there are social media platforms, but it's very much online. But how do you bring people together face to face, you know, interacting and all that? And that's how I came up with Pro-Cuddling South Africa.
Ubuntu is an African philosophy that promotes brotherhood. Professional cuddle therapy is also offered in other countries like the United States and includes a contract like the one offered by Letswalo. She says the contract stipulates that both the client and cuddler can immediately terminate the session if either party says they feel uncomfortable. Letswalo said so far that has not been an issue.
It's more than just cuddling, yes. It's a very personalized experience, and there's a reason why people book for cuddling. And the main reason, I think, is, you know, loneliness. We live in a society where loneliness is very prevalent. People are extremely busy, and also people don't really have anyone to talk to. I think when you get very busy and you don't really have a family, or you're very isolated, you get lonely and you just want someone to talk to.
The business has grown rapidly over the last year, according to Letswalo, from having a few requests a week to now having 2 to 3 cuddle appointments a day. She says her staff has also grown to about 50. Psychologist Anele Siswana says he welcomes this form of therapy and says that it also spreads Ubuntu.
The ethos of Ubuntu have to do with taking care of the other, has to do with brotherhood, with sisterhood. And for me, it's a classical way of making sure that even the service is an extension of that. The only difference is that it's a credible space that you have to pay for it.
Judging by Letswalo's business, cuddling, more than simply physical touch, is gaining popularity among South Africans as a means towards companionship and human connection. Zeri Kasim for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Sometimes gotta let it go. Eurovision 2023 kicked into full swing in the English city of Liverpool on Sunday. While Ukraine's Kalush Orchestra won the 2022 contest in Italy, Russia's full-scale invasion has prevented Kyiv from being able to host this year's competition, as is customary for the previous year's winner. And ahead of the May 19th first semifinal performance, VOA Steve Miller spoke via Zoom with Andriy Usulak and Jeffrey Kenny, known as the duo Tvorchi, who are representing Ukraine this year.
I guess where I want to begin is with your song, Heart of Steel, this year's entry into the Eurovision Song Contest. Jeffrey, how did it come to be?
Well, we wrote the song early last year. We didn't like pick a topic to write about, so we just kind of wrote it from how we were feeling. It was early during the invasion, so we kind of just put all that into the song, how we felt into the song, and yeah, we didn't expect to use it for the competition because we didn't know we were gonna. At that time, we didn't plan or we didn't even know we were going to apply for the competition. So everything just kind of fell into place. But the message of the song is strong, and that's why we're using the song to represent the Ukraine this year.
You know, you said that you weren't planning on using the song or even really knowing that you were going to apply to represent Ukraine for this year's 67th Eurovision Song Contest. Andriy, can you explain how it came together?
You know, like, I think every artist and every person who is involved into art has its own, you know, own ways to create different things. Is it a painter or movie or music? For us, it's just some kind of thing, you know, you just, every inspiration is everywhere. So you just go there, do, and then you have it. Like, you just, you know, you don't think when you do, actually. You just get, like, some inner energy. I don't know how to call it. It's very hard to explain. You just do, and
like, it internally resonates and just manifests. Definitely. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I have a question about how you guys came together, because, you know, reading some of your biography, you were both in university. You know, Andriy, you're Ukrainian. Jeffrey, you're from Nigeria. How did you meet? You know, I have a chemistry and biology backgrounds. I used to dance and sing in the lab while I was, you know, doing my experiments. So, but how did y'all come together?
It was a random day, and I just, you know, we met on the street. I saw Jeffrey walking. I tap his shoulder and say, "Hey, I would like to check out my English skills, and you know, we can gonna teach you some Ukrainian." So that's how we met and how the friendship started. But the most interesting fact is that I never meet people outside like that. This was just once in my life, and I don't know, in my head I had that time just to win, no thoughts, you know. So, and then after some time we discovered that we actually in the same university, same faculty, and after one like a year we discovered that we can do music, you know, together. It was also like the first song was made like we just sit in my kitchen, ate pasta, drank some beer, and I played some music that I made, and Jeffrey just started writing lyrics, and then we recorded the songs, then we released, and then after that song goes another song and another, so just everything goes by its natural way, you know.
That's VOA's Steve Miller speaking with the duo representing Ukraine in this year's Eurovision competition. This has been International Edition on Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler, we thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourselves a very wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Biden-Harris administration is determined to expand legal pathways for migration to the United States and prevent people from taking the dangerous journey to the border. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas recently outlined a series of measures in support of this goal. One of them is the establishment of regional processing centers in select locations. The first such centers will open in Colombia and Guatemala. Secretary Blinken praised the two countries as excellent partners.
These centers will be operated by international organization partners and improve qualified individuals' access to accelerated refugee resettlement processing, family reunification, and labor pathways in the United States. There'll also be a referral point for lawful pathways as well as humanitarian refugee protections in other countries like Canada and Spain.
Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas noted that another way to expand legal pathways is to streamline the long-established family reunification parole processes for Cubans and Haitians so that individuals from these countries with approved family-based petitions can more quickly reunite with their families in the United States.
Third, I have directed my team to develop family reunification processes that will extend this well-recognized model to certain individuals from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Colombia.
Fourth, through the successful Customs and Border Protection One mobile app, people will be able to schedule more appointments at ports of entry. The Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela parole processes, as well as the corresponding returns to Mexico for those without a legal basis to remain, will continue, said Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas. At the same time, we are imposing consequences for individuals who do not use our lawful pathways. Those consequences include a 5-year ban on admission to the U.S. and the possibility of criminal prosecution for any subsequent attempt to cross the border illegally. Let me be clear, said Homeland Security Secretary Mayorkas, our border is not open. The approach of the Biden-Harris administration is focused on making migrations more safe, orderly, and humane, and on advancing the interests of the American people, declared Secretary of State Blinken. He also underscored the importance of working with our regional partners. There is a mission at the heart of the migration challenge, Secretary Blinken said. How can we all work together as we are to provide the foundation for better, more secure, and more hopeful futures for all our citizens?
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.